Welcome to Law Subscribed. This is your dedicated news source for all things subscriptions in the law. My name is Matthew Kurbis. I'm the subscription attorney, and I believe subscriptions can help bridge the access to justice gap and incentivize attorneys to modernize and scale their practice like never before. On this show, I interview lawyers ditching the billable hour and experts who can help attorneys move beyond billing time. Thanks to my sponsors, 650 and Gavel, links to both in the show notes, more on them later, and use the code LAWSUBSCRIBED when signing up. You get 10% off, and it supports the show. The best way to support the show is to share it with someone you know. This podcast is for educational and entertainment purposes only, and nothing said is legal, ethical, or financial advice. Without further delay, here's the episode. Jeff Carr, welcome to the Law Subscribed podcast.
Thank you, Matthew. It's so good to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, I'm thrilled to have with me, I think at least as far as I know, the podcast's first ABA legal rebel. So there's some articles and some interviews that you've done in the past, but just in case my listeners haven't come across any of that yet, how about you go ahead and give yourself a brief introduction?
Sure. So as of now, I'm a race car driver. That's what I do. I'm on my fourth retirement in various neighborhoods of law land. I started out in big law. Then I actually did a clerkship after about a year in big law for a federal judge. Went back to big law, did that for about 4 or 5 years. Then I went off on my own and started a consulting firm with a couple of other guys. And we did international trade consulting and a little bit of investment banking. Did that for about 5 years. I like to say during that period of time, I got my MBA and I got it the hard way by starting a business and running it right into the ground. I then left, and this was 93 when I left the consulting firm, and I went in-house. And so I was in-house for the vast majority of my career. Eventually became the general. I started out as international counsel for a company called FMC Corporation. Eventually became an assistant general counsel for a business unit. That business unit was the lead of a spinoff. We split the company in half. And I then became the general counsel of FMC Technologies. Did that for a very long time, 14 years, and retired from that back in, 84, I think. I'm sorry, 2014. And then I taught, I worked for a couple of ALSPs and did a little consulting on the side. And these days I'm retired and a race car driver. So race car driver sounds a lot more interesting than telling people that you're retired.
Yeah, I definitely think so. And while I the race car driving thing is super interesting, I want to have you here today because you know, it's a lot of the work that you've done, and one of the reasons why you were named a legal rebel is because of your work trying to end the billable hour. And so, you know, now I think my audience knows that since you spent a lot of time as in-house, you know, you were the client, right, for these law firms that were just billing a stupid amount of hours. And during the time that you were doing it was even before the e-discovery days. So that's when they throw an army of lawyers at something and just bill an ungodly amount of hours, right? So is that part of your experience then as in-house?
Absolutely. And it goes back for when I was in big law. The very first project I worked on, I was a first year associate. I was part of a team, and every Sunday night or Monday morning, we would fly from Washington, D.C. down to Newport News, Virginia. There was a team of about 12 people. We would go to a bank building, like a bank warehouse, where each day we were given 50 boxes of documents for discovery purposes. My only job was to put a green piece of construction paper in that box where I wanted copies to be made, and a red piece of construction paper at where I wanted to stop in that box. That was it. I wasn't supposed to analyze the documents. That was somebody else's job further down the chain. This was just documents we wanted to pull out for further analysis. We did that every day for 2 months. We could only get 50 boxes a day, but it wasn't just activity-based billing. It was sort of opportunity cost billing because the entire team was in Newport News, Virginia. We were billing the customer, a very large oil company. I think we were billing them 10 hours a day, despite whether we were working 10 hours a day or not. And it was that experience in and of itself that set me on this path of thinking, this is just stupid. I mean, it's a great business model if you can get paid for activity, but from the customer's perspective, it's a horrible model. And so I spent most of my career trying to change that. And we started it when I was at FMC Technologies. Actually, we started at FMC Corp. We ran, I think, the first reverse auction on the internet for legal services. We developed a program called ACES that was a model that I now talk about it as being based on delivered value and trying to get away. I mean, you have to understand that customers don't want to pay for activity and they don't want to pay for inputs. They want to pay for results and outputs. And yet pretty much the entire law land business model is based on activity. The only segment that isn't based on that is really the plaintiff's bar, and which is sort of interesting. So, you know, it's just something I thought it was daft right from the beginning, and I was in a position to change it, at least for my employer, and we did.
Yeah. So, man, there's so much that we could go down with that, but just to be clear. So you were working in big law and you were billing time and you weren't even in your experience providing your clients with value. You were just providing them with stuff that you were doing, busy work.
Correct. I mean, it's stuff that had to be done. Yeah. Of course, it didn't have to be done by a lawyer. And as you said at the start, this was back in the day of microfiche. That's how old I am. You know, it's like back in the Cretaceous period. It was incredibly inefficient. And then even in the days of e-discovery and even in the days of augmented review and things like that, it's still pretty much activity-based. I mean, it might be volumetrically based, but it's still pretty inefficient. And the model fosters inefficiency, frankly.
Yeah. And I think a problem with even still lawyers today, but especially back then, I'd love to get the perspective, is do you think any of those lawyers ever ask themselves, do I want to just pay for activity? You know, do they ever put themselves into their client's shoes and think about if they as an individual, whether as a business owner, if they're a partner, you know, for the ones making the decisions to send the fleet of associates, or as a person, as a consumer of services and goods, would you, when you go to the doctor, you know, do you want to pay them just because they saw you or because they helped you in some way? You know, like
I think that, that's exactly the right question, is exactly the right perspective. I don't think many people ever ask themselves that question. I think they're convinced they're doing a great job. I mean, I remember one of the important moments in my consciousness was seeing a BTI survey at one point that it said, 75% to 80% of lawyers think they do a great job for their clients. In the very same service, it said less than 25% of general counsels would recommend their primary lawyers to others. You can't have those two data points. They can't coexist unless either one or both parties are delusional or they're not talking to one another. And I think it's that they weren't talking to one another. I think that's the root of the problem. There's a really simple fix for this. And I challenge you and everybody that listens to think about this as something they can do to change their perspective. Ban the word client from your lexicon. Every time you want to say client, say customer. Because every time you say customer, you have exactly that subtle shift that you just alluded to, which is, would I pay for this? Do I think I'm getting good value? How would I feel if I was a customer for this service provider? What would my experience be? If you make that one subtle change, believe me, your whole perspective on the delivery of legal services will change.
Yeah. And perspective is a perspective shift is really valuable. For example, I mean, I've had lawyers who have come on the show or I've just spoken to lawyers who they're not sure that they're using the subscription model, but like, they're like, well, I don't use the subscription model. I just charge my client the same amount every month. It's like, well, you know, let me break it to you. That's the subscription model. And when you start thinking about your relationship with your clients or customers as a subscription type model, you start thinking about your relationship differently because now you have to be providing them value and help them maximize their monthly subscription benefits so that they stay subscribed and you continue to deliver value and all that. It totally shifts the paradigm when you start thinking about that and reading the material on the subscription economy and the membership economy and all that, right? So I think perspective is incredibly valuable. And just because you call your clients customers doesn't rid you of your ethical requirements to your clients.
but obviously not.
it's a reframing of, and I'm saying that mostly just because I know we have legal technologists listening to the show and they have no clue about legal ethics. So that's not for the lawyers. That's for the technologists selling to lawyers who are not lawyers themselves. You know, you can't just get around the legal ethics by doing that. But it's really important. And like I thought of an example while you were talking of the medical thing that I've never thought of before, but I think it's relevant. It's like, could you imagine if you lost your finger in an accident and you put it on ice, went to the surgeon and the surgeon sewed it on backwards, and you still had to pay them because they spent hours doing the surgery. Even if your finger's on backwards, you still owe them money. Well, what if a lawyer spends a bunch of time doing something that ends up providing no value? Right, it's the same sort of a thing, but in the lawyer's mind, they have such a hard time divorcing value from the time spent. But that's not the value. Right. The value is in even sometimes telling somebody this NDA or this contract is perfectly acceptable in the form that it's in. I don't need to make any edits to it whatsoever. There's value there, and it doesn't have to show a bunch of work. What do you think about that?
I think that's absolutely right. I think there are sort of, to me, there are three elements of value. It's effectiveness, which is what was the customer's objective? Did we, and the customer has to be clear, you know, take litigation. I want to win. That's not a particularly great objective, you know, because in the real world, especially in the corporate context, winning means resolution at the lowest possible cost, unless it's something important for some reason. Mm-hmm. But unless I tell my litigator that, what that litigator here, she has heard, I want to win, you know, so no stone unturned, all effort, you know, burn the bridges. Well, that's not exactly what I want. I actually want resolution, probably 90% of the time. The second element is efficiency. That is, okay, what did we decide this was going to cost? You know, what's either fixed price or a subscription model, whatever it may be, or billable. If it's billable, what's the budget for it? How did we do? You know, are we above budget, below budget? If we were fixed price, did you keep coming back to me asking for a change order? You know, that's sort of irritating. And then the third element is experience. And I think of that, it's not the experience of the legal service provider. It's the customer's experience with the legal service provider. So it's customer experience or CX. You take those three elements, and at least to me as a buyer, they're equally important. You know, if you were wildly over budget, but great to work with, that's sort of interesting, but you know, that doesn't help me in my corporate setting when I go talk to the CFO. If you were incredibly effective, but a pain in the ass to work with, that doesn't help me in terms of my daily life in the company. If you were incredibly efficient, but were neither effective, nor was it a good experience. Well, I mean, all I got out of that was a good price for bad service. So, you know, those three elements all coexist. And they need to be alike. That alignment is actually what's the most important, you know, because if you think about the law firm or the lawyer business model versus the customer business model, it's a really simple XY axis. You know, there's a billable hour rate on one scale and a number of hours on or total cost on the other. I'm willing to pay a whole lot of money for very few hours. My curve goes, you know, from left to right descending. The law firm's curve goes from right to left, or left to right ascending. You know, more hours means more revenue. You know, if you're a classic economist, there's a point in the middle where those converge. That should be the clearing price. And, you know, that would give you a theoretical hour per cost per hour. If you want to get better performance, though, you want to shift that point of convergence to the left. That frees up an area of savings between the two curves. If you're a customer like me who believes in fundamental fairness and alignment, I don't want to keep that savings. You know, I'm not a greedy customer, nor do I want to give up that savings. I want to share that savings with my provider, because what that model does is it encourages the model. It pays more, a higher hourly rate effectively for better results. It frees up inventory of the provider to sell to somebody else, presumably at a higher margin as well. I get better results at a lower overall cost, even though it might be at a higher per hour cost than I would have paid for that same number of hours. But it's not as high at that so-called market clearing price. I don't know if that makes sense or not, but it's all about alignment. It's recognizing that my business objectives diverge from the service provider's business objectives. That's okay. We just need to find a mechanism to align them. That's all.
You said something important that I want to highlight, and that is, and I think this is you, it's coming from, I think, your in-house counsel days, but I think this is true of any customer or any client in any practice area, and that is you were willing to pay more money for good results sooner. Even if it was, right? And that is, I think that's incredibly important. And I think pricing certainty that comes along with subscription and flat fee billing or a combination thereof, right? That gives the client pricing certainty in the beginning of the engagement, right? Sure. And so if you are incentivized, so it is more valuable typically to get the results sooner, just generally speaking.
Correct.
For an end user of the legal services.
That's absolutely right.
If you're billing your time, you are not incentivized to get there sooner.
They're at the exact opposite. So the ACES model that we built, you know, because I'm a lawyer, my team was lawyers, the first model we built was incredibly complicated because lawyers like to complexify things.
Yes.
And it was for litigation specifically, not for other matters. Very complex formulas, but it kind of came down to the same, exactly what you said. I want to achieve success. I want resolution more quickly. And it incentivized that. It then also incentivized part of our model said, okay, we need to have an exposure level for this unexpected value is what we called it. We used decision trees to figure that out. That became the bogey. And so one of the multipliers of the holdback in our model was, what was the divergence, positive or negative, from the expected value? What was the divergence, positive or negative, to the overall budget? And so, you know, in our model, well, that's the complicated model for litigation. There's a much more simple model that works for anything. It would work for fixed fee. It would work for a subscription. It's you pay 80% of the amount that's agreed. 20% is held back. Periodically, the provider gets a report card based on those three factors: effectiveness, efficiency, and customer experience. Based on that report card, you get somewhere between 0 and 200% of the amount billed. Over the lifetime of my time at FMC Technologies, on average, we paid our providers 107% of invoice. So not too bad, you know, it's more money than they billed us. But we also went from a $1.8 billion company with a $14.8 million legal spend to an $8 billion company with a $9.8 million legal spend. The company tripled in size, yet we reduced costs by a third. I would submit you cannot do that simply by cutting costs, simply by reverse auctioning, simply by, you just can't do it. You have to change what you buy and how you buy it. And that's what we did.
And what you did also is you created an incentive for the law firm to provide good value delivered, right? Hence the delivered value that you talk about. And so I think with the versions that I've come up with for subscription and flat fee for litigation, there's a similar idea there. I think it's great to introduce my audience to the 80% paid holding 20% back with the possibility of earning even above that 20% if you deliver something that the client determines is valuable. So right. I'm happy to introduce that, but what we've talked about previously on the show, and I'm curious to get your perspective on, is, and I'm just going to throw out random numbers here and with like somewhat percentages, like, but this, nobody should take the numbers I'm about to say and use them in their litigation. They should look at the data. They should consider their market that they're serving, the amount of damages at stake and all that, right? But let's just say, you know, you get a case, let's say it's a high volume case or like something like insurance defense collections or foreclosure prosecution, things like that, right? These high volume cases. So these are going to be, I think, relatively low numbers for litigation, maybe not. So let's say you get the case in, it's $1,000 flat fee straight up because there's going to be either briefing or you're going to have to file the complaint, you're going to need to respond to the complaint, all that, right? So $1,000 up front, $250 a month, so 25% of what the flat fee was as that goes on. And then you have incentives to resolve the case. So maybe it's a $5,000, or, you know, maybe that's too high in this example. Maybe there's like a $3,000 or $4,000 incentive if we settle and resolve the case. So upon settlement and resolution, you get a significant payout. And perhaps even that number goes down. So if we settle within a year, it's $5,000. After that, it's $4,000. Then after that, it's $3,000. And maybe there's a floor at $3,000, right? If we settle the case before trial. Then if you say go to trial, or you could have segmented, you could do a hybrid segmented fee. So it's like once we get to the expert discovery phase, that 250 a month goes up to 500 a month because now we're ramping up. We're going to trial. We're getting ready for trial. So now that monthly fee goes up when we hit expert discovery. And that's, you know, and that's built in to incentivize, okay, the client's going to know it's going to be $500 a month. Do we settle it? You know, we have a settlement offer on the table, or we're trying to settle it, resolve it, right? And then once you go to trial, it's one of these things where it's hard. And I may, maybe you have a good perspective on this, but because I've always thought you can't promise results at trial, because at the end of the day, especially if it's a, even if it's just a bench trial, it's still one person. It's just a human making a decision, right? Or people making decisions. So it's like a flat fee, and this depends on the area of litigation. It's either a per day or a per week fee, right? So maybe it's $1,000 a week, or it's or maybe even it's more than that because you don't want them to go to trial if you could avoid it, right? So maybe it's $2,000 a week or a $500 a day or something like that, right? And then you get paid, and then maybe if you get you could set it up with the client, but if we get a you know a zero judgment, maybe there's a bonus on top of that, right? A multiple on the legal fee. So you could create these incentives with the subscription and the flat fee, where the client knows what they're going to be paying. Let's say, okay, so the case takes 3 years. At a maximum, we could budget. We know it's going to cost this much. If it takes 3 years and it goes to trial and it's a 5-day trial, this is what it's going to cost. And they could plan for that. What do you think about that?
I think that's what you've just described, Matthew, is conceptually the same thing as the ACES program. The ACES program is just a little bit more structured, if you will. You know, I mean, to me, you have to sort of put litigation is a great, played a fantastic example, because to a company, litigation is an irritant. You know, disputes are an irritant. They happen. They're part of life. I would like to get to destination zero, but you can't. You know, you are always going to have litigation, either as a plaintiff or as a, more likely as a defendant. The name of the game is really cost-effective resolution. And so that's precisely what the ACES model contemplates. But it's also, because of its structure, it deals with those cases that are incredibly important as well. Most cases aren't. You know, you have to kind of put cases into three categories. One is just the normal crap that happens. And there you're just looking at resolution in the most cost-effective fashion. That's probably, I would say probably 80% of most litigation. There's another 15%, maybe 18%, that for some reason has some importance to it. You know, either you don't want to set a precedent or the dollar value is still high. There you're still looking for resolution, but it requires a little bit more effort associated with it. It's a little more important to you as the customer. And then there's that 2-3% of litigation, if that. That is either company threatening or so significant that, you know, you're going hammer and tongs at this thing. You've got to win. But I got to say, as I was in-house for, 25 years, the number of litigation that falls into that one small category was incredibly small. I mean, it might have been two cases over my entire career. And so, you know, you don't approach the cases that are just slice and dice, normal litigation, normal irritant, the same way you would the existential threat litigation. So you've got to have the capability, the capacity, the abilities, the judgment, if you will, to put things in the right bucket and treat them accordingly. But you also have to take a step back and just think about the statistics. Yeah, the statistics are something like 95% of all disputes are resolved without going to trial or a final finder of fact, an arbitrator, judge, or whatever it may be. And the ones that do settle tend to settle on the courthouse steps, you know, very late in the process when you spent all the money, which is just stupid when you come right down to it. So in my world, it was all about early case assessment to figure out, okay, is this something, if we're responsible for it, we will go, you know, we're going to pay it. We're a responsible company. And we're going to pay it. If it is arguable, you know, then we need to know what the probability of success is, recognizing that it is simply a probability. It's not a guarantee. And then you're balancing amount of money, the cost of resolution versus the cost of litigation. And you're constantly balancing those two. And you get to the point where, you know, it's a fight or flee. The earlier you can make that decision, the better off you are. So early case assessment is critical. An early evaluation is critical. And then you're constantly looking at the numbers. I mean, I used to go into mediations with plaintiff's lawyers on the other side. They didn't particularly like this when I said this to them, but I would show them our decision tree, show, you know, and say, look, this is the way we view this matter. And this is, this is the number that we are willing to pay. You know, it was essentially the expected value of the case. Now, every dollar I pay that person sitting over there, my defense lawyer, from this point forward, comes off that number. So it's up to you. You know, we can resolve this today at that number, or a week from now at a number less than that, and a month from now at a number even less than that. So unless things change in the probability assessment, your number is never going to get any better than this. They found that quite offensive, as you might imagine, you know, because they're a great litigator and they never lose a trial and da-da-da-da-da. But, you know, the fact of the matter is most cases do settle. So the question, if you're the customer, is how do you get to resolution most quickly? And that's really all it comes down to, unless it's something important. Unless, I mean, you know, like as a employment litigation is a really good example, or mass tort litigation, you can't let your company get the reputation that you file a claim, you get a check. You know, so we used to say, you have to earn your money the old fashioned way. You know, you actually have to prove if it's mass tort, you're going to prove premise or product ID, and you got to prove manifestation of injury. Without those two things, we're not even talking to you. And same thing with an employment claim. So, you know, there's stuff like that that you just have to approach things with the right kind of both a tactical and a strategic viewpoint.
Right. I want to talk about these. You have like the three different types of law firms. So we're going to talk about that next, but I want to set it up in a very important way that's related to this conversation we're having. So
sure.
In the subscription economy, there's a concept called LTV or lifetime value. It's what is a customer worth over the course of their life to your business? And can you give them value the whole time? And what are they going to pay you in exchange? So it doesn't just apply to the subscription economy, though the incentives are built in when they're a subscriber. Right. So this applies to anyone, any lawyer representing clients, but in particular, sticking with litigation. You know, let's say I'm an outside firm that's used to, you know, maybe like we want to file the lawsuit because that or they want to file the lawsuit, but we file a really great motion to dismiss or something like that to try to get things resolved right away because we're trying to get this case resolved and settled. Maybe, you know, like think about it. Like you said, this is what I was thinking of. I was thinking of we settle right before trial. And I used to do insurance defense work. So we settled so many cases right before trial, right? And it was usually for less than maybe something that we offered earlier on.
Right.
How it happens, and we didn't, you know, I didn't have like diminishing policies, but it was just sort of the reality of, you know, you just never know what's going to happen at trial. We made more money. They paid less, but ultimately maybe the insurance company would have paid the same. So what I'm thinking is, you know, if you the law firm, and I think this is how a lot of law firms think about it. If you the law firm think, well, I don't know if I'm going to, and this is where the subscription model comes in, because if they're paying you every month or every year or whatever it is, then you do have this client and you want to keep them happy. But I don't know if this client's going to stay subscribed or bring another case to me or whatever.
Right.
So if we litigate like crazy and I have a $10,000, you know, fee that they've paid over the course of the case, and I handled much smaller cases maybe than what you used to handle. I was a small insurance defense outside counsel firm, right? But so let's say, you know, we made 10K from this case, but we might not ever see that again. So we want to, you know, even if we're not consciously saying we're going to drag this case out, we're going to do this, like, you know, the underlying business model is such that we want to we get one bite of the apple with this case, with this client. We want to make the biggest, juiciest bite of the apple. But maybe if we helped reach quick resolution, we would have made $2,000 on the case. But right. The client's super happy. They're not pissed. Even if they ended up paying less, like, you never know, you know, in total, in aggregate from settlement and legal fees. You know, they don't hate having, you know, seeing a $10,000 bill compared to a $2,000 bill. And you're going to, and if you just settle and reach these cases that the client's happy, the plaintiff goes away, you know, you might make from this client hundreds of thousands of dollars over the lifetime of the relationship when you're thinking of it that way. And so some of it just takes, you need this long-term perspective of the relationship between lawyer and client that is simply lacking with, I'm going to extract as much time out of this case as I can because that's how I make more money.
I think those are great points. And one of the challenges, I think, with litigation is, first, the client doesn't want it. The client doesn't want to hire you again. You know, they hope that this is the only case of this type that they ever have. The reality is, you know, they're going to have probably more of this stuff, but they really don't want it. So you have sort of a couple of dynamics going on. One, you really don't have assurance of a pipeline, I think, you know, so the lifetime value concept is a really important one, but it's built on sand in some ways, you know, the basis of it, it depends upon the existence of litigation. That might be rational depending upon the type of company, but it also might be ephemeral, if you will. So that's one dynamic that you got to deal with. Now, I think there are ways to deal with it. One thing that I see, one thing we were committed to as a legal team, but I found very few outside firms that actually embraced this, was the concept of an after-action review. At the end of every matter, you sit down and you talk, the entire team talks about two types of improvement. They talk about it in terms of what went well, W3, and things to take a look at, or TALAs. But in two separate areas. One is on the process. You know, what did we do well? What can we improve on the litigation itself? But then taking an even deeper dive and saying, why were we here in the first place? Because I'm a believer that litigation disputes are a lot like safety incidents. Every single one of them is preventable. It is always a human error. It is seldomly a lawyer's human error, but it is always a human error, either in design or in execution, always. If you accept that as a premise, then you can say, okay, well, what can we do to deal with that? How can we not just mitigate it, but eliminate it? So one of the ways that folks that do defense litigation or plaintiffs litigation can add tremendous value to their customers is a very active after action program, you know? Now, but that's, I mean, just think about that. You're shooting yourself in the foot. You're telling your customer how to not need you again. That is so counterintuitive to most litigators that it's difficult to get them to understand it. But put, as you said earlier on, put yourself in your customer's shoes. Does your customer want to have the same type of litigation again? Recognize that they may have it again, but do they want it? And the answer to that question is no. So then the question is, well, in order to not have it, it's their behavior that has to change. It's your customer's behavior that has to change. Their processes, their procedures, their whatever it is, that has to change. That's tremendous delivered value. Now, if you're on a subscription model, this is where I think this becomes very, very interesting. If you're on a subscription model and you are handling lots of cases for people, and the model doesn't depend upon the number of cases per se, but just sort of the on-call availability, particularly if you have it structured in such a way that you're incentivated to resolve it. If you go to trial, okay, you know, then you got to get paid more because that's taking more activity out. If you're in that kind of a subscription model, you have tremendous incentives then to help your customer be better so that they don't have to require your services going forward. And virtually, I haven't worked under this model, but conceptually it makes sense to me that if you had 100 customers all paying you a subscription and say two of them had a piece of litigation, you're going to be upside down in the relationship on those two. You know, you're not bringing in enough money from those two customers to fund that particular piece of litigation. It's the 100 customers that you have that are paying your subscription cost. And so then if you specify how you do stuff, standardize how you do stuff, couple it with an effective after action program to change the behavior of that 100 customers. And yeah, you're always going to be there if you're needed, but both you and the customer actually hope that you're not needed, which is that becomes a really, really interesting business model.
When I went solo, I pivoted from mostly litigation to a transactional-only practice. I did not have a database of documents to automate. That's why a business and employment legal document database and automation tool like 650 is super useful. I can rely on the quality of the documents in 650's database since they're putting excellent legal minds to work curating and updating their documents and automations over time. When you're not billing by the hour, outsourcing and efficiency matters, and 650 can help you scale your practice to get high-quality documents drafted in less time. Use the code LAWSUBSCRIBED at 650. Business50.com and when being onboarded to get 10% off. If you're not a business and employment attorney or you have your own documents that you'd prefer to use, then my next sponsor, Gavel, is the automation tool for you. Gavel allows you to build shareable, client-facing workflow and document automations. In other words, Gavel helps you create a legal practice where attorneys can monetize the value they bring clients in productized form and scale via subscriptions and flat fees. Use the code LawSubscribed at Gavel.io to get 10% off an annual subscription. There's no one right way to automate and scale your practice, but with one or both of my sponsors, 650 and Gavel, you can take your subscription law firm to the next level. Links to both in the show notes. Now back to the show. Yeah, I mean, you nailed it. And before I even follow up on the point that I wanted to make sure we hit on, like, this is what non-law firms do with their subscription business, right? So if I'm a software exactly. company, I have a customer support team, and I have thousands or millions of clients, right. of customers signed right. up as a subscriber, I can't have a customer support person for every single person calling in. So exactly. I'm going to assume that maybe only X percent, 10%, 5% are going to have calls. Right. I'm going to pay for that, and then I'm going to price accordingly. Because if I had to hire enough customer support people, no one would subscribe to my product because it would be too expensive. So it's a exactly. similar, it's a similar kind of thing. You nailed it. Going back to this, it's the problem avoidance thing. That's where the subscription model comes in really well, because as long as you continue to provide problem avoidance value, that's lifetime value that you're providing right there. So let's do right. this after action. Let's find out how to avoid this from happening at your company forever into the future. And we're going to have monthly, maybe even weekly, or quarterly, you know, check-ins with your people. We're the litigation firm, but now we're selling litigation avoidance, which, by the way, I sell on my website, court/litigation avoidance. And we're going to sell you litigation avoidance because we're the litigation experts. We know how to avoid it. Right. But because we're making money from you every month, we're your problem avoider law firm, not your problem solver law firm. And in the lifetime value perspective, we're going to make more money from this client over the course of the next 50 to 100 years than we ever right. would have made on like the 10 cases before they got sick of us because we charge too much money on the hourly rate that they can't predict.
Exactly. I think if you're working under that model, then you also have to be cognizant that you're going to have some customers that you don't want. You know, you're going to have some customers that don't embrace the after-action recommendations. They don't change your behavior. So over time, they become a drag. And so either you charge them more or you fire them as customers, either one, because there is a cost associated just as you were saying in the IT area, there's a cost to support that particular subscription. It's not self-help. It's not online resources. You know, it's requiring more hands-on stuff. It's requiring more specific assistance in particular kinds of disputes. And so at some point you just say, I'm sorry, you're not a good customer, or I'm going to, it's almost an insurance model. You know, if the customer becomes high maintenance, they pay a higher premium. And I think that's, I mean, as an example, I toyed at one point with trying to build a new type of legal service provider. It's sort of office of general counsel in a box. And we would do everything for the customer for a fixed price, based on a percentage of revenue. The only things we wouldn't do, we'd manage litigation, we probably wouldn't handle litigation, but we manage it for them. But the whole idea was, for most corporations, public corporations, most of them spend about 0.5% of revenue on all legal services. It doesn't matter what buckets it in, that's just an overall number. At my FMC Technologies, we were spending about 0.18% of revenue. So that, I mean, that's not, if you think about it in terms of percentage reduction, it's a big reduction. If you think about it in terms of overall revenue of the company, yeah, it's millions of dollars, but it doesn't actually move the needle very much. And that's actually why it's hard to make these sales, because the cost of legal to most companies, even though it's in the millions of dollars, it's not significant enough to take the risk of a new type of service provider. That's sort of that sort of model of the office of GC in a box. It runs against the marketing reality of lawyers are really good at convincing customers that law is a black box. You can't predict it. The risk is huge, and therefore you need to spend a lot of money with me.
And we have a monopoly. We have a monopoly on legal services, which is starting to show cracks in it, right? Arizona, correct. Utah come to mind.
Correct. Right? Correct. And that's driven by, you know, I'm reminded by the Jeff Goldblum line from Jurassic Park, you know, life finds a way, customers find a way. I mean, the fact that so much of what we might call legal work is being done by other types of entities, and the fact that the ABA and others are fighting tooth and nail on the unauthorized practice of law, that's the battlefield right now. I mean, but ultimately the customers will find a way. And so we can either be part of the solution, or we can hold on to what we have and hope that we get to retire before the whole world crashes in.
And I mean, that we haven't even touched on generative AI and how that's changing the game, because talk about customers finding a way. They're going to use these tools. There are legal AI assistants right now that have been trained on millions of legal documents, all of the case law, all of the state and federal laws. And they are basically the equivalent of like a 5+ year associate.
Exactly.
And hey, do 5-year associates make mistakes? Yes. But you know,
of course,
the AI is going to make fewer mistakes, and it's more predictable in its mistakes that it makes. Right. So if you could, a task that used to take tens of hours now take tens of minutes. And so billing time is simply not the most profitable way to make money. And your clients, just like with e-discovery, will demand you use the technology that's available to you.
I agree. And then just take that another step. If you think like an in-house lawyer, it's not the use of AI in litigation, in dispute management. It's actually the use of AI in prevention. Mm-hmm. That's the next frontier. Because, you know, I used to think about this in terms of there's four waves of change in legal. The first wave is about what you're doing. You know, it's does this have to be done? This does not have to be done. The second wave is about who and where, you know, who's doing it, where are they located? That's just a labor arbitrage, a cost arbitrage situation. The third wave is optimization, how each task is being done, optimizing it. If you're like me and you were head of a department, your job is to constantly optimize and reduce costs while you're managing risk. If you optimize the hell out of your department, you know, you're doing absolutely everything you do as efficiently and as effectively as possible. The CFO and the CEO still come to you and say, oh, that's nice. What are you going to do next year? And you got nowhere to go. Yeah, I mean, you've optimized everything in theory. The only place you can go at that point is the demand side. It's not what you do and how you do it or who does it. It's now, why are you doing it? That is almost always due to the behavior of the company. That's where you start embracing this preventive law thing, where you start talking about, we want counselors, not lawyers. You know, I don't want a gladiator. I want an insurance inspector. You know, I want people that are going to tell me how to change my business, change my behavior, change my people, change my processes so that I don't get in trouble. I don't want janitors, you know, and that's what I used to say this all the time. Most of my job was being a very, very well-paid, well-dressed janitor. And I, you know, I really like cleaning up after the elephant. You know, I would rather feed the elephant less so it produces more crap that I have to clean up. Most people don't think that way, but that's actually your job in-house. It's when I need a litigator, I need a damn good one, depending upon, you know, a horses for courses kind of thing. But I actually would prefer to not need a litigator. You know, I would prefer to not have facts and circumstances that put me in that position. The outside counsel, they're necessary because you can't staff up for everything that you might need as an in-house lawyer. I mean, even a huge company with hundreds of lawyers can't have enough bodies and headcount to do everything. So it really comes down to how do you marshal the resources to do the job to be done. And eventually you get to the point of saying, well, why am I doing this job? You know, why am I cleaning up after this elephant? Why don't we try to get the elephant to produce less crap? And so it's not a common perspective. It's a very, I think, unusual perspective amongst people. And largely that's because, you know, I come from from the same tribe. You know, we're both lawyers. Sometime in my career, there was a shift that I started thinking of myself as a business person who happens to be a lawyer, who happens to be tasked with delivering legal services to my company. Most lawyers don't think that way. Most lawyers think, I am a lawyer. I am a professional. I do wonderful work. The quality is superb. My experience is unparalleled. I mean, whatever it may be. But that's not necessarily what the customer needs or wants. You know, that's the interesting thing about this whole dynamic, I think.
Right. And the janitor analogy is actually a great one I haven't come across yet. On my website, I use plumbing as an example, as an analogy, right? Do you want to hire the plumber after you have a burst pipe? And they're going to charge an arm and a leg, or a plumber, you maybe pay a plumber every month to come in and check all your pipes. And if they're leaky, they fix it. So you avoid a big expensive problem, right?
Absolutely. So I want to go back to your AI point though, because it's such an interesting one. You know, I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, I think people will use these various tools that are being developed, and they should. Will they hallucinate? Of course they will. It all depends upon what the corpus of the information is. The real danger in the application of AI to legal services is the belief that what you are getting, the output that you're getting, represents judgment. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't. It represents statistically valid sample of, in a million instances, this was the way this was handled. I think what's interesting in AI, well, let's go back. I have a different definition of a lawyer than most people have of a lawyer. To me, the only thing that makes a lawyer different than any other profession, any other kind of person, any other task, is legal judgment. And when I say legal judgment, I mean, okay, there is a situation. In most situations, there is an answer. You know, and most lawyers, of course, give the answer, it depends. Well, in business, that's not a very good answer. I mean, you know, I have a yes box, I have a no box. And, you know, I need to know. But what it really comes down to, and the lawyer will say, well, that's a business decision. You know, you and what they're really saying is, I'm not in charge of your business. It's not my money. It's not my liberty. It's not my family. It's not, you know, it's not this or that. It's your judgment on how to deal with this. I've given you the considerations. You make the decision. Can AI do that? Yes, it can. I mean, you could feed it a situation and say, but the answer that you're going to get is not judgment. It's just statistical analysis. Definition of a lawyer is someone who applies legal judgment. That's it. Any other task, if it doesn't require legal judgment, it need not be done by a lawyer. Now, the system, the platform might have been designed by a lawyer, but it could be operated by anybody. But if you think about it in terms of a process, and there are 57 steps in the process, but only steps 7, 27, and 56 require the application of a lawyer's judgment, those are the only steps the lawyer should perform. Other people should perform the other steps. In those instances where you need a lawyer judgment, I define it as it's a situation where here are the facts, here are the inputs. You can turn left, you can turn right, you can go forward, you can go backwards, you could stay still. You know, those are kind of the basic options. None of those options is correct. You know, they're not, and they may be equal to one another. They may have puts and takes, but the judgment side comes into, under these circumstances, given my situation, I would choose to go forward. I would choose to stay here. Whatever that's, to me, that's legal judgment. Right. AI can't do that. And so the question is, how do we use AI to get us to the point where the lawyer then helps the decision maker make that decision? And I think that's possible. And the fear is that as the LLMs become more sophisticated and get more data, it will look like legal judgment. The output will look like legal judgment and might be mistaken for legal judgment. So the care has to be taken to how we build these systems and use these tools to get us to the place where judgment needs to be applied.
And this is why I'm not afraid of the AI revolution, because the subject matter expertise of lawyers will be able to look at the out. First of all, they'll be able to do the proper input into the AI, right?
Yep.
So the legal subject matter expertise that we have, and then we'll be able to analyze the output and apply that legal judgment, like you said. And nobody is better suited to do that in the legal industry than trained, licensed attorneys.
I don't think
we're going anywhere as a profession. I think it's going to radically shift how we practice law. But I also think we can't be charging, well, not that we can't be, it's that the most profitable way to make money is not charging by the hour unless you charge $25,000 an hour, because you're only going to have to spend a few minutes on those things,
right?
So then we have to change our business model, which is what the podcast is really all about. So going back to the analogy, you know, I think medicine is one that we have all the time. And like law and medicine, yeah. To go back to your janitor example, is like we don't have a healthcare system in the U.S. And anyway, we have a sick care, right? It's like people have medical problems, then they seek help. Same thing with the legal profession. It's the same problem.
Right.
Now imagine with this problem avoidance, preventive law firm type vision, that instead of being janitors where we clean up the mess, we are architects, engineers,
right.
Where we are designing the building of our client's legal situation from the beginning to not have flaws so that there are fewer cracks and fewer problems in the future. And engineers and architects make a lot of money to do that, right?
Right.
So
right.
We can do it too.
We got to figure out what is the billing model for that. And that's a challenge. That's definitely a challenge. I mean, the only thing I've ever been able to come up with is a percentage of revenue based upon the type of company. But then with this hold back results-based performance kind of thing as a way to kind of correct stuff. I don't know, you know, if that's the right way to do it or not. The beauty of the ACES model, frankly, is it works with the billable hours. It's not a massive change in the way lawyers work, but it's a significant change and it's more aligned with the customer expectations. If you apply the more simple ACES model to the subscription model, I mean, to me, the problem with fixed price, the problem with subscription is there's really no, other than firing the provider, there's no real way to gauge or correct performance problems or service experience problems. You know, I mean, the customer might give you feedback. Whether that's taken into consideration or not is the crapshoot. But it doesn't really deal with quality or service problems. It deals with cost certainty, which is incredibly important. But the ACES model takes that, you know, I think it addresses the other two elements, the effectiveness and the customer service expectation. And then it aligns everything. Because the most important part of the ACES model is communication. It forces the buyer, the customer, to be clear about what their expectations are, clear about what they're willing to pay, you know, what the budget makes sense or doesn't make sense, and then clear about what the customer service expectations are. So that's at the front of the relationship. As the relationship is ongoing or at the conclusion of a project, it requires the customer to give meaningful feedback. There's no magic in the 20% holdback. The only reason we used to use that number was it was a significant enough portion of a profit margin of the traditional law firm model to make the law firm or the lawyer pay attention. And then there was enough upside to make the lawyer unleash their competitive aspects of things. What do you mean I got a C? I was a Supreme Court clerk. Yeah, I know. That didn't matter in this engagement, but all the numbers are kind of scorekeeping, you know, but it really comes down to communication. It's a service business. And, you know, in a service business, you need to understand what you're buying and then you need meaningful feedback. It's one of the reasons I don't like most service evaluation systems that are out there. Because if you think about it, you know, like 5-star ratings and things like that, the reality of the world is that service providers are a bell curve. You know, most people are good, adequate, average, whatever word meets requirements, whatever words you want to use. Very few are exceptional. Very few are horrible. Most are in the middle. Most evaluation systems, however, provide not a bell curve, but a bimodal distribution. Most evaluations are, everybody's wonderful, Lake Wobegon effect. And then there's this relatively small amount that's truly horrible. The reality is everybody's average. And so part of what you need to do with evaluations is most evaluations have no consequences whatsoever. And so that I give you 5 stars because it costs me nothing to give you 5 stars. And heck, you might find out that I gave you 4 stars and oh my God, then, you know, then next time my service might be horrible. So I'm going to give you 5 stars. Where the reality is, no, you met expectations. You're actually a 3-star provider and there's nothing wrong with being average, but the way we think about things is we have a hard time. Good, you know, in our world, average is not acceptable. Good is not acceptable because I've always been exceptional. So, you know, but the reality is you might be exceptional in terms of your intelligence, in terms of whatever, it, but experience. But in this particular engagement, you did what I needed to be done. You met expectations. That's good. Nothing wrong with being good.
Right, right. I mean, going back to the thing about the subscription model where I think it was an important insight that you had where the evaluation is, well, I could stop subscribing, you know, if the services aren't good. And I think that's okay, though, because and what you could do is you can come in. And what I do with some of my bigger clients that have a higher volume of work, and sometimes it ebbs and flows, is we reevaluate. Okay, you know, over the last 6 months, you know, have you been getting good value for this monthly price? And if you have, great, we're going to keep doing it. Have you been getting exceedingly more value? Then we need to bump up the price a little bit because we're anticipating business is good, things are moving, you know, things are happening, and I'm helping you avoid legal problems. And then maybe, you know, maybe service is not good or there's not, you know, there's something is not working out. Maybe I need to give you next month as a break or we need to reduce the monthly price. And so I definitely have those evaluations with my clients. And because we're in a services industry, you know, we could do that. We could productize a lot, but at the end of the day, we're still providing a service. So like these tech companies can't do that. Like we could do it. I do offer prices on my website because it's just easier for consumers to understand. Sure. But I'm always willing to do a custom price because I can. Also because I'm a solo operation, so it's easy. I don't need to get approvals. I can do that. So I think that might solve that problem of analysis or of evaluation. But I do think that there's no better in the subscription business model. There's no better success fee than them staying subscribed and maybe even going up a subscription tier or increasing that monthly subscription amount. I think that's the reward for doing a good job and taking the legal things off your client's plate. But it's a long time play. It's not a per project play. It is a long time play.
And asking customers for constant feedback is difficult too. You know, customers don't like being pinged all the time but imagine if you only ask them 4 questions, you know, and you ask them this monthly or quarterly. And the 4 questions were, rank my effectiveness on a scale of 1 to 5. And it's a radio button. Right? You just have to push it. Rank my efficiency, 1 to 5. Rank my customer service, 1 to 5. And then the last question is, would you recommend us to others? Will you continue using us? Will you recommend us to others? If you just ask those questions and you had that feedback on a constant basis, that would be incredibly valuable. What's not valuable though, if it's an evaluation without consequences. So if they give you a 5 and they've given you 5s across the board and then all of a sudden they cancel, you've had no heads up as to what was wrong. Okay.
Right.
If they gave you a 5, they actually are going to automatically pay more money for your service, the kind of hold back, pay more money thing. So they're going to think long and hard before they actually pay you more. If they give you a 2, they're going to pay less money. So they're going to think about why I'm paying less money. Maybe they're cheap. Maybe they're bastards. Maybe they're just, you know, whatever. But that then gives you valuable input as well about what kind of customer you have. But if they're giving you a 3 across the board, then the conversation becomes you're meeting expectations. You're doing what the customer wants. Then the only questions you should want to know from them is, what can I do to be a 4? What can I do to be a 5? And all of a sudden, now you're having conversations based on continuous improvement. And imagine that data coming in on a constant basis for you. It would give you a heads up where you have customer problems. If you've got a whole series of customers that are ranking you a 2, which means there's a 10% discount from your rates, that's going to tell you something. If you've got a whole bunch that are ranking you a 4 or a 5 and you're making more money from that, you're doing something right. Now, you ought to want to know, okay, in those 3 areas, where am I excelling? Is it on customer service or is it on effectiveness? Or is it just across the board? So let's do more of that because the more of it, believe me, if there are evaluations with consequences, and you're getting 4s across the board, at some point you're gonna do exactly the same thing, but those 4s are now gonna become what's required. It's gonna slide back to a 3. So you're going to have to constantly improve how you're doing. If you're constantly having those discussions with your customer, even in a subscription model, you're now building sustainability into the relationship, because ultimately it is a relationship business. It's a customer service business. You got to be effective. You got to be efficient, but you also got to give great customer service. If you've got that feedback loop, you're constantly learning more about what the customer needs and what you can do better. And that's good for everybody.
Right. To round out the interview here, if it's still relevant to your way of thinking about law firms, I'd love to hear it. These versions of the law firm, I think ending with Next Law or Next Law Firm, or like there was, you know, I'd love to, for my audience to hear about how you've segmented the different types of the future of the way law will be practiced.
Okay. So old law. They're in the business of billing. They're not in the business of solving legal problems. They're in the business of billing hours to solve legal problems. New law, also not in the business of solving legal problems. They're in the business of billing lower cost hours to solve legal problems. Engaged law is in the business of solving legal problems effectively and efficiently. And then next law is in the business of preventing legal problems from ever arising. In Jeff Land, Next Law is the highest and best use. You know, it's if you're a cubby devotee, you know, it's box two. It's doing stuff that's important but not urgent. That's the highest value. The hard part is figuring out how do you charge for that. You know, and I think what you're doing, the subscription model, is probably the best way to think about it. You know, it's some combination of subscription, insurance concepts, performance-based fees.
Right.
All sort of built in. I think that's the next frontier.
Yeah, yeah. And I think the subscription law firms or firms leveraging the model are in between the last two. The engaged law firm, did you say?
Yes, engaged.
Yeah, engaged and next law.
Yeah,
We fall into those two categories. And you can't, even me, I can't be in, I think I'm in next law a lot. But I can't be in it all the time because people still find me because they have legal problems. And so I have to solve their problem for them. But my experience with it has been, and this is where lifetime value comes back into play, is you could still charge a premium, but you can't charge as much as you might have when you were billing time, dragging things out in terms of the total quantity of fee for helping that client in that situation. So you just have to be comfortable charging less, which you should. Do you pay the plumber who fixes your leaky pipe to avoid a big problem as much as them cleaning up and fixing the burst pipe? No, of course not. But it's important. And over time, I think, because there's an education gap with the clients who for so long in this, because I serve the latent legal market. I don't serve enterprise companies, right? So like, you know, there's a massive education gap of they've been doing it themselves with legal stuff forever.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So once you help them cross that gap, then they can appreciate the value of avoidance for legal problems a lot more. And I think the low-level pricing that I offer, $20 a month, $50 a page, is accessible enough that they're able to get in and buy in. I even have small business owners who will come in at that price. And then one of the values of my subscription of the benefits are I stop counting pages when you get to a certain subscription level, right? So then now we don't have to count pages anymore because it's not as bad as tracking hours because it's really easy to be like, hey, this is a 10-page document. That's $500. Easy, right? So it's still a metric of usage, but it's a heck of a lot easier to understand than time spent on something.
Right.
But we don't like usage metrics as consumers or lawyers. So let's, you know, if you pay me for, you know, a 100-page contract, well, you might as well just sign up at the higher subscription level and we don't have to count pages, right? So people, when they're able to break it down in a way that they can understand, which time per is not like an activity fee, it doesn't sit well with folks. But if it's like, okay, like a per page fee, you know, I've had lawyers say, well, what happens if one page is like your indemnification clause and you're trying to make it mutual and you're going back and forth on indemnification? Well, what about the other 49 pages of that 50-page document? They're easy peasy. Who cares? Like, you don't have to increase the amount of fee per page. 50 might be low, but for my market I'm serving, it's perfect. And it scales really well. One page, $50. The client's more than happy to pay. They come to me with two employment agreements. We're talking about 30, 40 pages. I'm making a few grand on that client, right? So, like, it actually, you'd be amazed at how well a per page metric scales. But I use the Costco model, where first you must be a member. Now you get access to my below my discounted other things, right?
Yeah.
Unlike Costco, you can't buy in bulk because I'm just a solo practitioner. but that's the idea. And while people come in the engagement phase, that engagement law firm, if they stick around, it is more often than not that next law with the subscription model. So I think the pandemic and automations and technology and clients changing their expectations of going to a fancy law firm, fancy office and all that. You know, we all have Zoom and we all have everything now. Like the client, like now I think we're living in a world where that next law is more possible than ever before. And while I can't live in it every day, I try to. I definitely strive to, which is why I was so happy when I heard you talking about it, because I was like, I've never heard that before, but that is what I'm shooting for. That's my goal. So Jeff, any other words of wisdom for my audience?
No. I mean, you know, think like a customer, not like a lawyer, and think about how do you provide value. And I think those are, if you have those as kind of your North Stars, and it sounds like you do, Matthew, I think that's the future of law. I really do. And the only other thing that I would caution people about, and it's a quote from a guy that used to be the U.S. Army Chief of Staff, a guy named Eric Shinseki. And he said, if you dislike change, you're going to dislike irrelevance even more.
That's good. That's a great way to end the show. Although I do have one more question for you that I ask all my guests, which is a hot dog a sandwich and why?
Yes, it's a sandwich because it's between two pieces of bread.
All right. Well, Jeff Carr, if anyone wanted to follow up with you or reach out, what's the best way for them to do that?
I'm on Twitter under Carr Next. I'm on LinkedIn, but I don't use it a whole lot. People are welcome to contact me. I'm at jcarr906@gmail.com. Always happy to talk to people. I'm happy to share the ACES model with any. It's a spreadsheet. I mean, it's the one of the simplest tools you could ever have, but it would change your life. I'm happy to share that with anybody that's interested.
All right. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Matthew. It's been a pleasure. Been fun.
And that's our show. Thanks again to 650 and Gavel for being sponsors. The best way for others to discover this show is for you to share it with somebody you think would find value from it. Follow me on LinkedIn, since that's where I'm most active on social media, and click the bell towards the top right of my profile to get notified about all of my posts about this podcast and everything else I think is valuable for you to see. To get in touch, message me on LinkedIn or email kurbis@lawsubscribed.com. All links are in the show notes. Until next time, this is Matthew Kurbis with Law Subscribed.